Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Blaine Lord, whose new memoir is Born on the Bayou, and novelist Hester Young, who's making her debut with the thriller The Gates of Evangeline. Just like the title of his memoir says, Blaine Lord was born on the bayou. That's New Iberia, to be specific, and his book tells a classic tale of Southern manhood, coming of age during the boom and bust of the oil business. Now he's living in California, where he's the CEO and founding partner of Lord Murray, an independent wealth management firm based in Beverly Hills. Blaine, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
So what made you decide in your own life that the time was right for a memoir?
A couple of years ago, I had a health scare. I was actually at an LSU football game with my two sons, and we were walking to see the live tiger and hoping he wasn't hiding from the September-October heat. And I was walking downhill, my five-year-old's hand in one of my hands, my four-year-old's hand in the other, and I had a quick shortness of breath. And my brother-in-law was with me, a New Orleanian, and he looked at me and he said, Blaine, you all right? And I said, I think so. But in fact, I wasn't. We flew home the next day, and 24 hours later, I was on an operating table having a triple bypass at 45.
Wow. Yeah.
And there's a cutoff period in life, and that is the day you go from being young to being middle-aged. And nothing puts an exclamation point on that like a line through your chest and waking up with tubes and, you know, your brother crying on one side of you and your wife crying at the other side of you. And, you know, as I woke up, I thought to myself, everything is impermanent, including me. And my sons and my wife and I live in L.A. and my sons are going to be Los Angelinos. And I wanted to honor my heritage, you know, in South Louisiana. And more importantly, I wanted to help them understand, you know, the men and women who had come before them. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this chapter, and that short story rolled into, you know, ultimately a first draft of a book.
Was writing something you'd always wanted to do? Did you have it in the back of your mind?
You know, it's a great question, and it's something no one's asked me. But yes, I actually went to LSU to study petroleum engineering. But in the back of my mind, I thought I always wanted to write. And I wrote a short story for an English professor, and he gave me an F.
Ah.
And he said, you should never be a writer. And it's for a long time, someone told me, you know, the main thing you can't do to creative types or anyone is do no harm. The criticism you give, make it soft and make it positive.
Uh-huh.
But that English professor turned me away from my journals and from my words for a long time. And then, you know, I started writing a journal after I read this book called The Artist's Way. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Oh, yes. Fantastic book.
Three-page journal.
Yeah.
It started, the first line was, I think I'm in a crisis of faith. And I've written three pages pretty much ever since 1992. And
right. That works. It works for people.
You know, the first part of the journal, I always tell people, you're going to just, it's going to be silly and you're going to be writing about your day and what you do. And then oddly enough, they roll into stories.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a classic coming-of-age tale, going from Southern boy to Southern man. There's a lot of male rivalry. There's a lot of male adulation. So tell us a little bit about your dad, Harvey Puffer Lord, and how he rose and fell with the oil business.
My dad was an only child. His father was a game warden for Louisiana, one of the largest refuges in the South, Vermilion Bay, mm-hmm. a place called Marsh Island. You know, his mom was she called herself a blue blood, but I don't know what that really meant. And he was a baseball star and a basketball star, and he actually got a scholarship to play baseball at Tulane. And as he says, when he flunked out, the quarter got to him. So he so he came home, you know, 22 years old, met my mom, his high school sweetheart, earlier. And in Louisiana at the time, there were, especially South Louisiana, there are few choices for guys without professional degrees, right? You can be a farmer, yeah, or you can work in the oil field. And he started in the oil field as a surveyor for Texaco. And, you know, he had that kind of raconteur, southern personality. He had a facile tongue, and people liked him. And he met a man, and that man hired him to be a salesman for his oil and gas consulting company. And, you know, one thing led to another, and he thought he could do it on his own.
There's this passage in Born on the Bayou where you describe their rapid ascent, and I wonder if you'd read that for us.
Yeah, happy to. The year was 1975, and the country was slogging through Watergate and the end of the Nixon era, yet optimistically looking ahead to a red, white, and blue bicentennial. Dad was 36 and a patriot, but the color he liked most was green, the green rectangular paper embossed with portraits of dead presidents. He wasn't alone. Throw a rock at a coon ass in South Louisiana and you'd likely hit one who'd made it. While most Southern oilmen at the time were living fat and owned Mercury Marquis, a Cadillac, or a Lincoln Continental, some of the worldlier oilmen in the region imported BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes for themselves and their wives. However, no matter how classy they were or pretended to be, they still plastered their backsides with industry-related bumper stickers like, "Let the bastards freeze in the dark." "Dad, what does that bumper sticker mean?" I asked as we headed out for a hunt. "What, son?" "Let the bastards freeze in the dark. It's a reference for drilling oil and the need for it." "Who are their bastards, Dad?" "They are Yankees and the other people who are against drilling." "And do you want them to freeze in the dark?" "Not really, Blaine. It's just a metaphor and an irony that they need our oil for heating their homes, but they don't want us drilling for it." Our family had new toys, new clothes, and our Tuesday night all-you-can-eat Pizza Hut meals had been traded up for family nights at Pats and Henderson, the Petroleum Club, and other local white linen restaurants where we ate frog legs, fried shrimp, etouffee, gumbo, oysters of all sorts, and all the Louisiana delicacies later made famous by Paul Prudhomme or Emeril Lagasse. Like a young movie star after his first big payday, Dad, and consequently the rest of us, quickly acquired some consumer habits. Dad became a collector of Winchester Model 12 shotguns and exotic field knives. He also took to wearing dress all-in-ones. His favorite was powder blue and white hound's tooth, belted at the waist with a small silver buckle, and he owned at least 10 pairs of animal skin cowboy boots. He also spent plenty of money on leather goods and belts of all types. He had two custom leather belts that he wore most days. One had Kunas branded on the back of it, the other read Puffer. He hunted doves in these belts, attended sales meetings in these belts, and went to the funeral home in these belts.
Wow. Like a character in a James Burke novel, you know?
Yep.
Come to life. And just as, you know, the rise was rapid, the fall was precipitous as well and dramatic.
Yeah. You know, obviously, economists have different views on market tops. And as we like to say, you know, it's always obvious after the fact.
Yeah.
And hindsight bias is 20/20. But in 1982, Ronald Reagan unified tax rates. And in that unification, they did away with this thing called intangible drilling cost. Whereas, believe it or not, and I think I'm remembering it correctly, if you gave a drilling company $100,000 and it was a dry hole, you could write that $100,000 right off of your income taxes. Mm-hmm. And of course, the oil and gas business has so much leverage in it. If they struck a well, you probably made $1 million on that $100,000. So for the very rich, it was a boon. And also, there was a hardline press. West Texas Intermediate crude had gone from $4 to around $40 over a 10-year period of time. OPEC had increased market share worldwide from 10% to almost 35%. And the nature of the game changed. So OPEC started to open spigots and prices went down. And, you know, my dad was a diligent saver. He was relatively prudent. We lived good, but he also saved a lot of money. But, you know, no one can save enough money for a 10-year bear market. And so by 1995, I think I write in the book, you know, my dad pretty much was out of business, working for someone else. My older brother, who, you know, had started a very successful career in Hollywood, was starting to help them. And, you know, we always say, you know, health is our most important gift. And I agree with that. But unless you've gone through it, no one understands what money and the lack of it can do to someone. It took away my dad's joy de vivre, and he just took away his pride. He just, as I said in the book, you know, he never walked the same, he never talked the same, and he got insular. And
that's a story so many people in South Louisiana can relate to, because they've had that firsthand experience.
The most surprising thing about this book for me, and frankly, I wrote this book as a cathartic experience. You know, I make my living managing money. I always will. I love what I do. But I had to tell the story of my dad and the men like my dad. Mm-hmm. You know, so we set up an author page on Facebook for Born on the Bayou. And the people who have read the book, most of the comments are just like yours.
Yeah.
My dad went through the same thing. Our family was never the same. He died in 2009 of a broken heart. And I just could relate to this whole kind of bell curve of a life, especially a life in the commodities business, because it's so boom and bust.
Now, I have to say that there is so much sadness in this book and such a real kind of personal reckoning on your part about you and Brian leaving and finding your own way in California. But there's also a lot of joy. There's a lot of hunting in this book. Hunting is a big thing here.
Hunting is a big thing in South Louisiana. And yes, it was a big thing for my dad. You know, it's the way we bonded. He really wasn't interested in going to football games and watching us play a whole lot. But he was interested in loading up the car and going away on the weekends to kill things.
And drinking. A lot of drinking in this book.
A lot of drinking. A lot of drinking in the South Louisiana, maybe even here in New Orleans, I hear.
I think so. Mm. And lots of women.
Lots of women.
And lots of lawn equipment.
Lots of lawn equipment.
I mean, you have one of the most loving descriptions of lawnmowers I've ever read in my life.
Thank you.
And I've witnessed that firsthand in my own brother. You know, it's just a thing.
You know, it's funny. I tell people, you know, we live in Los Angeles and no one has lawn equipment. Everyone has a gardener.
Yeah.
And in Louisiana, when I drive through, yesterday, in fact, driving from New Orleans to New Iberia, you know, I saw some guy cutting his grass and it just made me homesick.
See, it's little things like that. So how hard was it for you to leave? And what is it like for you when you come back?
That's a great question. You know, I never wanted to leave. I grew up, you know, thinking I would be in New Iberia, Lafayette, New Orleans, Baton Rouge my whole life. I mean, you know, I went to LSU and it was very hard. I looked for a job after I graduated from college in 85. And, you know, there's a piece in the book where we talk about that. And the only thing that was left for me was bank tellers. And, you know, insurance salesmen. And the only city I knew besides New Orleans and Baton Rouge was Houston, because my dad always traveled there to work. And I sent some resumes to some people there, and I got a hit with this company called Houston Financial Group, and I knew Houston, and I left, and I was still part of the South, but it was hard. I moved to L.A. on a whim. I went to see my brother, and by that time, he was kind of moving up. He sent a limousine to pick me up at the airport that he'd borrowed from one of his boss's clients who was on a movie set. You know, there was a white placard for me that said my name on it. You know, we went to his little apartment. He had a futon set up for me. And we drank margaritas. The sun was out. It was 72 degrees. And I just thought, maybe I'll try it here for a bit. But I honestly thought I'd only stay for a year. And truth be told, you know, my heart's where my family is. And you know, my boys and my wife, we live in L.A. And we've built a great life there. And I have a great business there with a great team and great friends. But when I come back here, my heart's more full.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people who write memoirs say that, you know, it gives them a kind of peace to have this kind of reckoning with the past. It moves them along from one spot in their life to another. Do you find that this did this for you?
You know, I've been thinking about that a lot, Susan, and the truth is that I feel like I've honored my father, and I feel like I've also honored my mother and my brothers and my sister, and I feel like I've written a little bit of history about a place, short place in time, in a very particular place that I'm proud of. Mm-hmm. And yes, I can put a period on the story of Puffer Lord.
Well, there's a lot of love in this book and a lot of pain. We've been talking with Blaine Lord, whose new memoir is Born on the Bayou. You can meet him at the Louisiana Book Festival October 31st in Baton Rouge. Check out louisianabookfestival.org for information. Blaine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hester Young is making her debut this fall with the Southern Gothic mystery, The Gates of Evangeline, set in South Louisiana's Bayou Country. Hester has obviously come a long way from studying creative writing at the University of Hawaii and then writing in the snowy Northeast. She's speaking to us today from her home in New Jersey. Hester Young, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be welcoming you to New Orleans in just a few days. So tell us how Louisiana captured your imagination as the setting for this book.
You know, it's a strange story. I had never been to Louisiana prior to deciding to write this novel. It actually came to me in a dream that I had, which sort of served as the inspiration for the story. In the dream, I was sitting in a rowboat in a Louisiana swamp with a little boy sitting across from me. The little boy told me his name, he told me his age, and then he said, "Let me tell you how I died." And he proceeded to tell me this really riveting, horrible story, which served as sort of the opening scene for the novel now. And the Louisiana setting, that swamp, really kind of stayed in my imagination, and I knew I just had to set the book there and learn more about this place.
I love that you'd never been here and still dreamed it. mean, so tell us about the research you did.
Well, amazingly enough, as soon as I kind of decided I wanted to do this project, within a few months, three different family members moved to Louisiana,
New
Orleans area. So it just seems sort of fateful and perfect that suddenly I had a reason to go down there visiting family. We had a home base, my husband and I, to work from when we went out on all these research trips, visiting plantation homes, doing swamp tours. We got to experience Mardi Gras in New Orleans, which appears in the book. And then spending a bunch of time out in Cajun country to get a sense of what that was like.
There's really nothing like it, is there? It's an amazing place.
It really is. The swampland was just fabulous. And as someone who's a New England native, just the people of Louisiana are so warm and kind and friendly in a way that is so unlike what I grew up with. It's fabulous.
And I think we'd love to be written about too. So
don't we all?
Oh, now one of the things about this book is that it's a melancholy kind of book, you know. Charlotte Cates, your protagonist, Charlie, comes to Louisiana after losing her young son. So this is a journey both of healing for her and of exploration. She kind of opens a door by doing this.
Yeah, it is very much a character story, I think, in addition to a mystery. For me, I love mysteries. I love suspense. But I hate a mystery that as soon as you as a reader figure out where it's going, and usually I can figure out where a mystery is going, I don't want to lose interest once I know what's going to happen. I have to care so much about the characters that things can play out exactly the way I think, and that's okay because I love that character and I want to see them get there so badly. So that's what I was hoping to write with this story, something where the character would resonate enough with you that all the suspense and twists and turns, those are important, but the heart of the story lies in the protagonist and her personal journey.
Now, Charlie has mysterious visions that guide her and sometimes puzzle her. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that part of her personality.
The character of Charlie actually is based very loosely on my grandmother, who also had very dark premonitory dreams. Back in 1956, my grandmother had a 4-year-old son named Bobby, and she started having a series of nightmares about him in which she would look up from doing the dishes in the kitchen and she would see Bobby fall from a floor above. And when she ran outside to go to him, she would find nothing there except this smashed melon. Well, one day my grandmother left Bobby with her parents and unfortunately a window was left open and Bobby did fall from it. The way my grandmother tells the story, when she went to the hospital and was speaking to the doctor, he told her that her son's injuries were fatal because his head had been crushed like a melon from such a great fall.
Oh.
So this character resonated with me because I've seen my grandmother, I've seen the baggage that she's carried throughout her life from that. So that was kind of my starting point for this character and what she goes through.
And Charlie's grandmother is such a remarkable character in this book as well.
She is, and she's very much based on my grandmother and my relationship with her. My grandmother passed away in 2009, but it was lovely to kind of resurrect her briefly in the pages of my book.
Ah, that's one of the great pleasures of being a writer, isn't it?
It sure is.
So you've already announced that this is the first book in a trilogy. So what's next for Charlie? Is she going to stick around Louisiana for a while?
No, the concept always was that each book in the trilogy would be set in a different location, and that that location, as in the first book, would serve almost as a character in the story and give the story a very particular flavor. I'm somebody who's lived in a lot of different areas in my life, so I'm very excited to have other places I can write knowledgeably about that I love very deeply.
Well, I hope you're going to write about Hawaii. I
mean, Hawaii is hopefully going to be in the cards for book 3.
Oh, good.
Right now.
Well, why do you only see it as a trilogy? Why don't you see Charlie just going on and on and on? I mean, do you really foresee an end in book 3?
I guess we'll have to see how I feel after 3 books with a character. You know, it's a very long relationship to have, and we're not married and committed forever yet, but maybe we will be. We'll see.
So how close is Charlie to you, really? You know how they say your first novel is often autobiographical. How much of yourself is in Charlie?
I would say there are some passing resemblances, but I am not at all fashion conscious. I couldn't stand living in the hustle and bustle of New York City. And I certainly didn't have the troubled upbringing that she did. So I think there are some pretty substantial differences between her and I.
Mm-hmm. And what's the great challenge, do you think, of keeping a character going through 3 novels?
I think keeping a character who is still growing and evolving in ways that readers are still interested in. I think when you get to the end of this novel, you see that she's entering a very new phase of her life. And so that will be continued in the next 2.
Good. It's a wonderful ending. It really is. And I enjoyed this book so much, not only because of the setting, you know, we all love these kind of gothic stories of great old houses and family trials and tribulations centered around the houses and hauntings. But I think the plotting was really kind of ingenious and wonderful. And I really enjoyed the way it turned out.
Thank you.
All right, we've been talking with Hester Young, whose new novel is The Gates of Evangeline. You can meet her Wednesday, September 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Hester, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Andrew Mallon Millward, author of I Was a Revolutionary, appears in conversation with M.O. Walsh, author of My Sunshine Away, Tuesday, September 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Randy Fertel discusses A Taste for Chaos, the Art of Literary Improvisation. That's at the Jung Society, Tuesday, September 8th at 7:30 at Parker United Methodist Church, 1130 Nashville. Free to Jung Society members, admission for others. The One Book One New Orleans 2015 event season begins Wednesday, September 9th with a kickoff Lights Out Party at Handsome Willie's, 218 South Robertson. The event title is a pun on the blackout in the title of this year's selection, New Orleans Boom and Blackout, 100 Days in America's Coolest Hotspot, the blackout that occurred in the middle of the 2013 Super Bowl. Author Brian Boyles will be in attendance signing books. Today's guest, Hester Young, signs The Gates of Evangeline Wednesday, September 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Crux by Ramez Nam, Saturday, September 12th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Robert Brantley signs Henry Howard, Louisiana's Architect, Saturday, September 12th from 1 to 3 at the Louisiana State Museum's 1850 House Museum Store, 523 St. Ann Street, from 1 to 3. The National Beat Poetry Reading in New Orleans takes place Saturday, September 12th at City Park's Morning Call, 2 to 5 or 6. Music by The Shiz. Participating poets include Julie Kane, Mona Lisa Saloy, Asia Rainey, John Gary, Kia Groom, William DeVault, Gina Ferrara, Biljana Obradovic, and a scribe called Quest. Wendell Pierce discusses his memoir, The Wind in the Reeds, along with Phyllis Montana LeBlanc, Saturday, September 12th at 7 at the historic Carver Theater, 2101 Orleans Avenue. Check out eventbrite.com for tickets or call the Carver Theater at 504-304-0460 with any questions. Limited seating available on a first-come, first-served basis. Melinda Rose discusses in Signs of the Rising Tide, a photo essay of the vanishing bayou community of Ile de Jean Charles, Tuesday, September 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And Tom Piazza signs his new novel, A Free State, Tuesday, September 15th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, September 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. The